I just didn't understand why some people who are so insanely talented at print couldn't understand that at heart they were storytellers and the medium didn't really matter.
Welcome back to Media Voices, everybody. You hear me say this every week, but we are the media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm a croaky Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston, and I've been in holiday. Yay!
Well, Peter, before you went on holiday, you did an interview. Who was that with?
Well, the interview extract that you just heard is Josh Schollmeyer. I spoke with Josh, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of online men's magazine Mel, a couple of weeks ago. Mel is different in a bunch of ways, but commercially because it's funded not by ads, not by subscriptions, but by the men's grooming subscription business, Dollar Shave Club. It was a really cool interview, actually.
Last week, we came back strong, I think, strong from our break with a raft of the most depressing news imaginable. So what do you say that this time we actually focus on some of the positives that have been happening?
Yeah, actually, like, we're not trying to skew the good news here. It was genuinely one of the things, like, when we were looking through to put together the notes, there were just so many stories of growth, basically. Yeah. So that stuck out really as a theme this week, which is good.
It's really good. I'm looking forward to the week where we have to do that thing that the BBC did in the 1930s and say, there was no news this week, and we just play some music. But yeah, so I suppose we should begin by highlighting the growth of one of the big e-commerce companies, because we did mention this last week. So Future have estimated profits of over £80 million this year. So Esther, what is behind that growth?
Well, this analysis is from Digiday. I can't claim this is my work, but Digiday say that Future's broad range of titles and their blended revenue mix, where they've got e-commerce, events and digital advertising, basically helped it weather this. And they've also got, because they've got quite a few really specialist titles with obviously specialist audiences, that's actually protected most of the ad revenue. You know, they've also had really significant traffic hikes, even in August, which is traditionally quite a quiet month. They were up 25% in the UK, 40% in the US. It's really looking good for them. And then you add in the acquisition of TI Media.
Yeah.
It's looking very, very rosy for Future indeed.
They've been focused on affiliate revenue for a long, long time. And I think it's just that. It's just that they were on a trajectory, and as we've said so many times recently, coronavirus has accelerated that trajectory. Mm. And like Esther's saying, they do have specialist titles. They have titles that, you know, that a long, long time ago, Future's motto was something about passion. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I think that's still at the heart of a lot of the stuff they do. And people, you know, get passionate about stuff and they buy stuff.
But Chris, I can remember doing this. I can remember doing the podcast with you 4 years ago, and I can't believe we say that now. But Future were hemorrhaging money, and they were basically buying up like all the lost random titles that nobody else wanted. And I remember sitting with you and being like, I wonder, like, what is their long term goal with this? And now it is really, really paying off for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they just happen to acknowledge the fact that if you can't go big, and a lot of their titles they couldn't go big, you have to go niche and really drive that kind of as much value as you can from a niche audience, and they've been doing this really, really well. That said, they have also made some pretty swinging cuts over the past couple of years.
What's the phrase we use? Right-sizing their business.
Right-sizing. I was just about to bring that word up, yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately, this is the proof that that was the right strategy. They cut the titles that they didn't see a future for. Or they could. Yeah. and just recently, in this latest raft of announcements, they said that they're not going to be renewing the licenses of Gizmodo UK and Kotaku UK because they don't see the value in licensing those brands from Geo Media anymore, which is a shame, not just for the people who work there or freelance for them, including me, but maybe they just didn't have enough of a presence with those brands in the UK to make it worth a while anymore.
Well, the Press Gazette article seemed to suggest that they've got quite a bit of traffic to those, but the way that the licensing deal went for both those brands, it basically meant that they couldn't, like, they were really struggling to make them profitable.
Yeah,
so I think that one particularly is a licensing case. But, I mean, they have also, you know, April they closed 6 print titles. They have got job losses planned as part of the TI Media acquisition with cost savings. So, you know, they, like many other publishers, are trimming in areas that they need to. But I think, yeah, Future also one of the ones that they paid back their furlough cash in July because they'd done so well on the other stuff in Q1.
I mean, it's, I don't know, it's that kind of thing. It's overall, it's very good news, but it is tempered by those job losses. We do, I swear to God, this is going to be a more positive episode. It's just that we, so, Peter, what then is the biggest positive that we can take away from the fact that Future is now doing better than expected?
I think what I'd love from these stories is the fact that this right-sizing idea that people actually are on top of a business model that makes sense, finally. Mm. You know, they are, okay, there are closures and there is cost-cutting and whatever, but they've got a model here that I think they can take forward. So I think that's the big takeaway from this, is they actually have a plan.
Like, I know they are well-known for their e-commerce stuff, but it, you know, it's like Digiday said, they do have a blend, and that has meant that when one area has struggled, the rest have been able to prop it up.
And actually, you know, one of the things to say about this is Future does brilliant content. They do really, really good content. So, yeah.
And they've had launches. Was it three? I think it was three sites they launched. Yeah. Oh my
God, the garden and the home thing. And...
Why don't you two just marry Future if you live in China? Well, moving on then. Also good news, The Atlantic has gained 20,000 subscribers in one weekend with a value of $1 million after US President Donald Trump said that it was, what was it, a failing magazine?
Dying magazine.
Dying magazine. Fantastic. I swear it was the fourth or fifth ever episode where we said that the Trump bump wasn't going to be a long-term viable strategy. And in a sane world, it would not be, but here we are. And even years down the line, in his fourth year of presidency, it can, his like vitriol can still drive his opponents to support one of his opponents. It's like the enemy of my enemy is my friend sort of thing, but for publishing.
So I've been on holiday, right? So I didn't really see this. But The Atlantic ran a story that said he was, well, whatever shade of douchebag he was being, they ran that story.
This is on where he insulted the military and he'd been calling the military losers.
Suckers and losers.
Yeah. What a dickhead.
Why do I want to go to that cemetery? It's full of losers.
he is actually certifiable, isn't he?
Oh, that's so funny.
What human would... Maybe he was just trying to be funny. Like,
you know, no, he wasn't.
It was just a little Trump joke.
No, it definitely wasn't, because it's not the first... The Atlantic story made it clear that that's not the first time he said that POWs or people who died in wars are losers and suckers.
Anyway, so he's insulted the military, and The Atlantic's reported it, and 20,000 people bought a subscription, is that right?
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. Welcome to 2020.
Oh, I swear to God, like, I wrote a piece for DCN a couple of months ago that was basically saying people take up subscriptions now not because of what a publisher stands for, but again, about who they stand against.
Yeah.
And the whole point of the article was, you know, places like the Byline Times make a big deal about how they're, you know, against the Tories and against cuts and everything. But Trump is doing The Atlantic's work for them in that regard. He's making clear that they're his enemy and people want to support them as a result.
But isn't there a danger here that we end up with a whole media industry trying to get Trump re-elected for 4 years?
This has been discussed. I've seen a piece on this already that if Biden was elected, they reckon a lot of traffic and a lot of the outrage would actually go down. But the one thing I'd say for publishers there is that any keyword blocking for Trump is suddenly going to send ad revenue soaring again. So it's not all bad news.
I thought that there was a really interesting point in this story though from CNN, which is that they actually had plans to launch their paywall way ahead of time, but they delayed it after Lauren Powell Jobs' Emerson Collective, which bought the majority stake, advised the company to actually invest in the editorial product and engineering before launching one. Yes. So they weren't just going to go for the MVP. They wanted to go for something that would genuinely add value to the subscribers, which is obviously, it's paid off.
Their reporting and stuff through the pandemic has been insane.
Well, they were one of those ones that actually made their coronavirus content free. And there's a really great quote in there from their sort of one of their chief editors who says that the coronavirus coverage helped with their brand awareness because obviously they're putting it out for free. It's getting people on side. It's making people realize that, oh, they're not the enemy of the public. But it was the articles on other topics that they then linked through to, like the politics coverage in particular, that was integral to actually converting those readers to subscribers.
Can we do a Trump special?
It's not going to be fun, is it?
I mean, actually, it'd be difficult to do an icon because our icon's already orange.
That's true. Like, completely just camouflaged against it.
That's just really two little eyes staring out at that sentence.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I mean, that is another good news story, although with the caveat that they did have to make some cuts earlier in the year. But The Athletic is one that I think, I mean, it definitely took me by surprise. So
yeah, I kind of had to read this twice, to be honest.
Yeah, well, you
Chris,
read it twice.
I loved your newsletter take on this.
So The Athletic, Esther, I think you put by some miracle, has hit 1 million subscribers despite there being no sport for half the year, which presumably is quite a detriment to a sports-focused publisher's strategy.
My miracle comment there is because there has been no sport for half a year, not because The Athletic aren't great. But yeah. Anyway, I'll let you take this one because your take on the newsletter was really good.
So, I mean, in the newsletter, I basically said, I have been suspicious of The Athletic for so long, and I was suspicious because they have been successful in an industry where that is so, so rare. So I kept waiting for the rug to be pulled out and for them to go, ah, no, actually, it was all a big scam. And like the owners have run away to the Cayman Islands or whatever. But that hasn't happened yet. This interview with CNBC is fantastic because Athletic co-founder Adam Hansman told CNBC that by all rights, the pandemic should have been the end of them. And that in the first few weeks of lockdown, there were days when they had fewer than 100 people signing up sports.
That got me fewer than 100. Like, if you're getting 100 people a day signing up, you're doing all right.
Not if your cost base is mental.
Which it presumably is, considering the amount of people that I don't know
what it was like in the States, but when they came to the UK, they just went around throwing money at people.
Yeah, they took all the local sports reporters, effectively, and a couple of the ones from the BBC as well, the big names. They decided that they were just going to own that space.
Throwing money at people is a bit ridiculous. I mean, they just paid them properly.
No, I think they literally threw money. It was like a T-shirt cannon that they just blasted people with until they agreed.
According to the CNBC article, their newsroom is actually profitable now.
Yeah.
It's just that the whole business isn't, when you take into account sort of finance,
but
HR.
That is such bollocks. That's like saying if I didn't have any costs, my business would be profitable.
It just means that all the reporters that they enticed over with really high salaries are actually paying their way.
But again, in June, they announced that they'd laid off 8% of staff and they mandated pretty much pay cuts across the board. But 3 months later, they have reached that
million. That's how their newsroom's profitable then. All the people that they enticed over with crazy salaries are now normal salaries.
It is a good news story, and I like The Athletic, and the people I've met from The Athletic are so smart, so switched on. But some of the chat around this is just so bullshit. You know, one of the quotes from this is, "We're literally at peak engagement." No, you're f***ing not.
What does that mean?
I don't know exactly. What does that mean?
Peak engagement to me is like you wake up and you roll over and one of the Athletic's journalists is
exactly
in bed with you.
Exactly.
Hey. Yeah. What are you thinking about? That's peak engagement.
No. That's an imprisonable offence.
These guys are proper like media bros. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's always been, yeah, we're going to take the world over, blah, blah, blah. And it's just that kind of thing. I think the fact that he comes out and said, we shouldn't have made it through this, is amazing.
Yeah.
The honesty there is just amazing.
Well, it's not just the honesty. It's the fact that they're very open about the fact that they decided that they were going to go territory by territory. They weren't going to splash out on this huge global launch. They were going to be profitable in one territory before they launched in another, which I think is where you've seen a lot of the expansion plans from bigger publishers fail.
They've done some bundling recently as well. You can buy The Athletic with a Bloomberg Business Bundle, which is a bit random, but I suppose, again, high-value individuals. And they've also got a T-Mobile bundle, which I thought was quite unusual, because that one apparently doesn't make them any money.
That's proper old school. That was right back to the earliest days of mobile contracts and stuff.
Well, anyway, good news for The Athletic, and it's, although I am still suspicious, and I do still...
Well, it's the VC thing's the suspicious part, right?
Yeah.
Because, they've got VC backers, and apparently they've got a 10-year window before anyone's going to start pressuring for an exit, which...
I think we do have to remember how young these guys are. Like, for a business that's, what, are they 3-4 years old? To have hit that is quite impressive.
In theory, paying people...
You're such a cynic.
But also...
come on, Peter, when does this ever happen?
Also, I think that this could be one of the points where actually they look back when we're however many years in the future if we survive that long. And the pandemic will have actually been good for them because the number of people, particularly in the US, that have looked at their sports subscriptions and cancelled them, and now they're looking and they're saying, right, I had cable for however many years, like, what can I now spend my money on? And everybody's talking about The Athletic, and I think that actually if they've managed to keep up that level during the pandemic, they are in a very, very strong position now.
Spanish newspaper El País has over 64,000 digital subscribers, despite only launching its subscription option on May the 1st. So talking about crisis kind of business models, this means it has the most paid for subscriptions for a Spanish publication, which means that it has almost a quarter of total digital news subscriptions in Spain. Spain was, I think, a relatively small subscription market before this, but that is still an insane stat to have.
I think if you look at the success globally of something like the New York Times, or even the Guardian's global revenues, surely there's space for a Spanish publication to take a global audience.
Absolutely. But yeah, the Neiman Lab said they've got about 400 correspondents throughout the world. They've got a fairly good foothold in other Spanish-speaking countries. So onto the news in brief. The Correspondent has launched an audio app to bring journalism to their members in new ways. So they've gone and launched two apps this week. One is in English for the Correspondent's audio stories, and the other is in Dutch for sister site Die Correspondent.
I guess it's a smart move.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm about to renew my subscription to this. One of the three or four things that I pay for regular. And I think this is a good addition.
Is this a paid-for edition, or is this just part and parcel of the membership?
So, it's quite interesting. So, you can get the actual audio stories on any podcasting app, but the experience of this app is just for members, because they've worked really, really hard on the design and the UX and stuff. So, yeah, you can get the stories anywhere, but if you want the really special experience and the ability to correspond with the correspondents, you have to download the app.
Okay, that's interesting. That's like that Quartz mentality to membership, where you just start and you just keep adding value to retain people.
Yeah, yeah, and I think like the app's got like a big privacy focus. So they said, you know, if you want to listen to it properly, come to us rather than Spotify.
We missed this last week, actually. I think it was just as we were going to record. But Extinction Rebellion blockaded printing presses in the UK last weekend. So they disrupted the printing of... Basically, they wanted to blockade Murdoch titles, but they ended up blockading a couple more as well. And there was a huge furore because people said, you know, they're the enemies of the free press. And Boris Johnson came out and said...
yeah. Sorry, just Boris Johnson, an enemy in the free press in the same sentence.
He was like, this is anathema to a free press. And then immediately the Tory government got censured for... blacklisting investigative journalists.
But it didn't make any difference, did it? Because all the Murdoch presses essentially just said, oh, that's fine, we'll just print a few extra down the road. Yeah. And it ended up with a bit of delay in newsagents, but unless you want to desperately get your paper at 6 a.m. on a Saturday, it didn't actually affect anybody.
No, it basically didn't. I think the thing was that the Extinction Rebellion were counting on the fact that the public don't know about print logistics, so they were counting on the headlines from having done it rather than any actual disruption. And to that end, it really worked. They got a reaction out of you. You got to give them that.
Regional publisher JPI Media, formerly known as Johnson Press, is reopening itself to bidders after coming through lockdown in a strong place. I don't know what that means. They're in a really strong place, but they've revealed plans to cut up to 30 jobs on top of however many jobs they've cut before. So,
are they in a strong place?
Well, that's kind of my question.
I'm talking of job cuts. B2B publisher Euromoney is also proposing 240 job cuts, which is more than 10% of its global workforce. This one's due to the impact of COVID on its events business, which, again, unfortunately, is no surprise. I'm slightly surprised they've only just made those cuts.
Furlough. I bet it's like, furlough. Well, almost a year after announcing a deal to unite, merger talks between Chumbox companies Taboola and Outbrain have ended.
I know. You won't believe the outcome of this story.
After they failed to agree on revised deal terms. I mean, ultimately, this, for consumers, nothing's going to change.
British Airways is scrapping the print version of its High Life magazine, which I always think of as High Times magazine, to be honest, and replacing it with a downloadable digital edition. This doesn't really matter because no one's flying anywhere, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know, I do read the travel magazine. Well, when we used to be allowed to fly, I did read the travel magazines, but it was always after you'd finished watching something, you just needed a screen break.
I've just finished John Wick 3. I'll leaf through and see what I can buy.
Anyway, so not content with cheekily hijacking links, Apple's latest iOS 14 update will use smart banners to prompt users to open stories to News Plus publishers in the Apple News app. If you are a publisher in Apple News Plus... please keep an eye on this, because this is really serious stuff.
Did either of you read this New York Magazine...
I read the extracts of it.
...profile of Ben Smith, you know, late of BuzzFeed News, and now of the NYT.
That's really the actual the lead paragraph's kind of weird just in itself.
A messy bitch who lives drama.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, he sounds like an interesting human being.
When you say interesting,
yeah, exactly. But
this is one of those things that anybody outside the media industry would actually care about.
No, definitely not. This was my question about this, because who cares?
We're in journalism. Most of us are messy bitches who love drama.
It's an end of an era for BBC radio journalists who are now being asked to reapply for new all-purpose reporter positions rather than dedicated audio positions. I suppose this is sad in a way, but it totally makes sense. You know, when you see some of the absolute tinfoil hat-wearing psychopaths that are calling for the BBC to be defunded, we should be doubling the licence fee and making people pay for it, Esther. Hey,
speaking of...
I've been speaking with Josh Schollmeyer, co-founder and editor-in-chief of online men's magazine Mel. We talked about Josh's frustrations with working at the legacy print behemoth Playboy, why that convinced him men's magazines needed to change, and of course the branded media business model that is at the heart of Mel's success. But first, I asked Josh to explain Mel to me.
The joke that I always use is that it's me working through some shit. So, you know, I had been working in men's media at Playboy for about 5 years, and I was really frustrated with kind of a very narrow, very stereotypical, very outdated mode or model archetype of sort of masculinity. And I think, you know, speaking of the UK, the laddie magazines, you know, for being kind of silly, were also meta in a sense of they were deconstructing and satirizing a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think they ever really evolved past that necessarily. Yeah. And you know, I was really interested in what the cut here in the U.S. was doing at New York Magazine, what Jezebel was doing with what was then Gawker, you know, the hairpin, ultimately broadly with Vice. And I thought, you know, they were really looking at gender in, you know, they were making that their beat as opposed to being really focused on consumer goods. So I really wanted to do something similar where I thought masculinity was sort of at this inflection point. And I wanted to really investigate sort of what was the place of the modern man in a rapidly changing society. So, you know, I really was trying to figure out as you know, a 30-something straight white male at the time, like what was my place in the world.
So was Playboy starting to unravel at that point?
I mean, it was just a very challenged business, you know. It was a hard brand to get your arms around. I mean, I was doing sort of a proto Mel there pretty successfully, but it was hard to get, you know, it's a big old battleship and it's hard to turn the whole brand in that direction, especially when you're, you know, more or less a licensing company and you're going to go for the big deals, you know, especially when you're carrying a lot of debt, as opposed to looking at what is the brand values that would play in the 21st century, I think. And, you know, it just becomes a very short-sighted enterprise. And that's really nobody's fault, other than the fact that when you become a behemoth, sometimes you can collapse under your own weight. And I think you lose sight of the kind of 30,000 foot view. I felt, and I think Mel has proven, that Playboy in particular had a really, I think, big opportunity to be sort of like the Atlantic or New York Magazine, one of a legacy publication that could remake itself digitally just around the conversations on gender and sexuality and social sexual values. And a lot of the bedrock of the brand from the 1950s and 1960s is encapsulated by the Playboy Forum and the Playboy philosophy. And, you know, again, it's just really tough. I don't know if like when it was imploding, I mean, I feel like that place was just sort of, even since the early 70s, kind of on just on one, you know, the highs were so high that it was just sort of one consistent trajectory down.
Yeah, and I guess it had its time and stuff changed and it didn't.
You know, people get comfortable. And I think around the late 60s, 1970s, he kind of, you know, you've got to still walk the walk and not necessarily just, you know, do as I say, not as I do. And I think that's sort of what happened to that brand is, you know, there was the Crusader Rabbit arm where, you know, Hef was the company and Hef were defending and trying to overturn antiquated sex laws and getting, you know, people who'd been in prison for fellatio and anal sex out of jail. You know, that was real mission-oriented stuff that I think fit really well into the editorial vision. That stuff started to fade over time. And I think that that's where you kind of lose your way.
I think Rolling Stone went through some, you know, similar kind of problems, but it seems to have managed to reinvent itself.
Yeah, and they're all founder companies, right? So, I mean, you know, it's what is Jan Wenner interested in? What is Hugh Hefner interested in? And how does that align with their own lives, one, and then two, with the audience? So, you know, I do think that the best stuff, and I feel like our stuff, I tell my staff this all the time, of like, it's got to come from our own lives. I feel like that's super resonant, you know? And at the same time, you have to hope that what you're experiencing is also what your audience is going through. And certainly, you know, at times when you experience the kind of fame, I mean, people would always ask me about, you know, what's Hef like? And I'd always say, he's like the nicest guy you could meet who's been like insanely famous and rich for 60 years. Like, he hasn't left his home in months. So, you know, there's a context there that I think, you know, he's not living the same life that sort of his readers are.
So going from someone else's founder company to your own founder company, and you know, that the joke that you make about working through some stuff, it's just exactly what you've said about your life and trying to match that up with your audience's life. How did that come about? Did you go to the Dollar Shave Club? Did they come to you?
Yeah, so I was doing something at Playboy called Playboy Safe for Work on what was Gawker Media's Kinja platform at the time. And we were up to like 2 million people a month with just like 10 posts a week. Tommy Craggs was really great at the time at Deadspin and started cross-posting a lot of stuff. And so did Max Reed at Gawker and then Jezebel. And we were picking up a lot of heat and really kind of, again, doing a proto-Mel and investigating gender, sexuality, masculinity. And I was just super frustrated. I felt really kind of alienated there. I didn't feel like, you know, that I think the Playboy GQ Esquire stuff, I think it appealed to like my dad. Like, I'm the first one in my family really to go to college. And I think it appealed to my uncles and my dad and my grandfather, that kind of aspiration, right? They could dream on it. Yeah. I think that changed with sort of Gen X millennials in terms of aspiration was about experience, was about a life well lived, not necessarily kind of consumer goods to fill a void. And it was so frustrating to have to do like sock roundups and watch roundups and hair product. Like, it was just, I just didn't feel like it was speaking to me in any real way. And then, you know, that was really the battle between digital and print. And I just didn't understand why some people who are so insanely talented at print couldn't understand that at heart they were storytellers and the medium didn't really matter, right? Like, if you know how to tell a story and you know what the brand is, you should be able to adapt pretty easily to whatever. And there was just a reticence to do that. And I was miserable, frankly. And I was so frustrated with legacy media in particular. And a recruiter reached out to me because they knew I was unhappy. And she was like, you should meet with Michael Dubin from Dollar Shave Club. And at this point, Dollar Shave Club was really young. I want to say maybe 24 months. I think there were four. Today in the US, Dollar Shave Club has 3 million members plus, I think. At the time when I started talking to them, they had 400,000. But Michael had a deep media background. He had been a page at NBC. He had been part of the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. He had worked for Sports Illustrated and really was interested in media and knew right away that while he was filling a pain point in men's bathrooms, there was also a considerable white space in the men's lifestyle market that there weren't a lot of people doing sort of what I was doing at Playboy. And I think you could put Grantland and Deadspin into that mix, but very much from a sports entertainment standpoint. So I started talking to him and he said, I want an Esquire meets Vice. And I said, well, I'm kind of doing that. Everybody said I was nuts. I just worked on like a movie that had been, I was helping produce a movie that had been shortlisted for an Oscar. You know, I had a very deep kind of literary journalism background. Everybody's like, you're going to go work for the cheap razor company. And I was just super fed up with, I just didn't think anybody was going to get it. I saw no evidence or indication that anybody in legacy media was really going to get it. And I thought if anybody's going to get it, it's going to be somebody totally out of left field. And I thought, why not take a chance? I mean, the first year was brutal, you know, just trying to figure out what it was, how to convince people. You know, again, people thought I was nuts, never thought it would work when I kept saying, well, we're going to be the Esquire of the 21st century. It was tough to get people to even take calls to entertain the notion of working.
Do people see you as almost like an advertising offshoot of Dollar Shave Club?
I mean, I think that, you know, you have to remember day one, it was nothing. You know what I mean? I was just calling people saying, hey, I'm from Dollar Shave Club. I've been brought in to start an Esquire meets Vice. And there was no proof, you know, there was no proof that you could do that. There was no proof that it would work. Honestly, the industry, this was 6 years ago, the industry was even very different. That was still seen as like a very verboten thing that you would even incubate a media property in a brand. I'm just not about pearl clutching. You know, like I've been inside the belly of the beast, and what they're doing is no purer, and they're selling considerable amounts of their soul. So to clutch pearls and point fingers always seemed counterproductive to me in terms of driving the business forward.
Do you think what you're doing is more honest then?
I've certainly had more creative and editorial freedom here than I've had anywhere else in my whole life. You know, I am allowed to do, I've had two edicts from my boss: hire the best people and do the most creative work that you can and stay true to the mission.
When do you think you would get a phone call from those guys to say, no, you shouldn't be doing that? What's the line that you would cross?
I mean, I don't know. It's been 6 years and we haven't done it, you know? So, you know, I think we are also, I think our editorial ethos really fits in the sense that we don't, I think the worst quality somebody can have is self-righteousness. Like, I don't ever think that I'm right. You know, I'm here to kind of have a constructive dialogue. And, you know, I certainly have values that I believe in very strongly. But I don't really want to tell you to do it like I do it, because it just works for me. My life works for me. It doesn't mean it's going to work for you. And I'm very open-minded to hearing about other people who seemingly are living lives that they're enjoying and what I can take away from that. So I think as long as we stay true to that and we continue to have constructive conversations about things, even if we get something wrong, admitting it and, you know, having a conversation around why we thought that way and why we should think differently is pretty fascinating. And I think that that editorial ethos helps stave off those kind of calls and criticism, because like I'm always open to hear what people say and adjust accordingly.
So from the idea of brand backed media, you know, if someone was coming along and said, I've got this publication I want to do, I want to find a brand that would back it, how would you go about that? What would you be looking for? How would you know you had the right brand?
A number of brands have approached me about doing something Mel-esque for them. And I always joke that I'm going to start a consulting company that just says no, because I think that getting back to like, I think this works for us. Right. And I think that this was a unique sort of marriage, in the sense that Dollar Shave Club was a very irreverent, intelligent, intuitive brand. And that's sort of what the Mel ethos is. You know, it's sort of always been ideally my editorial ethos. I think also there was just a huge opportunity in the men's space, lifestyle space, just huge. I mean, nobody else was doing anything different, right? So it made a lot of sense that those two things could kind of coalesce, right? I don't know if that's true of many other brands, you know? And I think when other brands have approached me, you know, one pretty big brand had talked about wanting to do a music site. And it's like, even if you have some degree of credibility in that area, right? There's a ton of music sites out there. How are you going to be different? What's your differentiator? Why does that ladder back up to, you know, even on the Dollar Shave Club side, we talk about the commerce side, and there's a huge firewall, but the commerce side is all about for your body. The Mel side is for your mind, right? It's literally what you read in the bathroom, essentially. And that makes sense, right? At a 30,000 foot big picture view, that makes sense. It's hard sometimes to wrap my mind around what other brands want to do as to how it could relate. I mean, some things, you know, there'd be other brands that I would say, oh, they actually have a huge opportunity. I think you've seen this in some of the with some of the real estate sites, right? Like as local newspapers closed down a lot of that coverage, they gobbled up reporters and started doing really interesting real estate coverage that also coalesced with, you know, sort of the site's, you know, financial business model. So I just think brands do a lot of things kind of clumsily, and it's sort of like the classic sports thing where you know, you rip off the playbook from the winning team and think it's going to work for you. And I just don't believe in that. I think that you have to really look at every situation individually and adjust accordingly. I think it's the same way with staff, right? Like you have to kind of, yes, you can coach up your staff and you can have values, and you know, we're obviously much more of kind of like a magazine-y website, much more about the zeitgeist, the news cycle, you know, more long form than bloggy. But you know, you do adjust accordingly based on who you have on your staff, you know, and playing to their strengths and trying to sort of obscure their weaknesses.
In terms of how the Mel brand and the Dollar Shave brand came together, what defines a common audience?
Well, you know, I think in some ways, Mike told me from the beginning that Mel's job is to attract a different audience, you know, that there's a certain audience that's going to go for the Dollar Shave Club marketing, and there's a certain audience that may be turned off to that. And I think, you know, Mel is an opportunity to, I think, talk to a different audience that maybe the core brand doesn't. So I don't necessarily know if it has to be similar.
So there's no metrics like KPIs. You have to get us so many people coming through to the e-commerce side of things.
Again, always a very distinct, strong editorial firewall. And the edict has always been just go out and do the best possible stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have. I mean, we've been very critically acclaimed. I think a lot of our competitors have, I know for a fact, because they've reached out to pretty much everybody on my staff, wanted to sort of get a little bit of the Mel magic. And, you know, we've just, you know, we're trending towards another 4.5 million this month. And so, you know, we're seeing a fair amount of market share in terms of what we're doing.
I think what's interesting about, you know, looking at Mel online is just the broad range of stories that are on there. You know, there's today, I guess, is just there's the lead is a documentary about Jimmy Carter. But then, you know, there's porn star penis stories, and there's the other end of this spectrum is nurses looking after coronavirus deniers. So there's an insane range of stories on there.
We look at the zeitgeist more than the news cycle, but it's hard to not cover coronavirus. I think the key is finding your own ways in. I have a very neurotic staff. And so like everything that was worrying them, I just kept saying, well, let's just make it into content. You'll stop worrying. We'll go get the answers. I think that there are some days that I walk away and I was like, does this all fit together? Or is it just in my mind that it fits together? But I don't know. We have a unique lens on what's going on in the world. I mean, to the porn star penis stuff, I think we've been very successful with male sexual health in terms of a traffic standpoint. And in large part, that's because men don't go to the doctor unless they're having a heart attack, you know, let alone go for anything else, where women have sexual health visits, you know, once a year. And I think we've provided a real service there. I know people always cite that as being like untoward or whatever. And I think that that's kind of crazy, because I want men to be thinking about that stuff beyond just the little blue pill or something like that. And yeah, I think Jimmy Carter is a perfect, like when it comes to entertainment and trying to find our way in, that whole doc by Barbara Koppel is about strength and toughness, and what actually, how do we define strength and toughness, right? And that Jimmy Carter, for a long time in America, was looked at as a weak loser president, right? Yeah. And yet maybe it's the kind of Jimmy Carter strength and dignity, the fact that that mission went so poorly, but instead of blaming and pointing fingers and what, that he got on television and said, the buck stops with me here. I made this decision. Yeah. This went wrong. And if there's anybody to blame, it's me. It's kind of incredible. And it cost him everything. It cost him a second term. It cost him really his reputation and legacy. And I think that that's an insanely Mel story, even though maybe on the surface, it doesn't seem like it's a kind of a piece that would run on a site for men.
Dollar Shave Club is in the UK. Could you see doing a Mel type story in the UK?
We have 4 or 5 editorial contributors who are based in the UK. I think especially in the West, it doesn't feel to me that the conversation about masculinity is that different country to country. I mean, we've done stories about MRAs in Pakistan, in India, we did a whole thing about forced castration. I feel like there's a lot of the same kind of issues going on that really aren't defined by borders. I mean, you're even seeing it with some of the same politicians, right? Boris Johnson and Trump, very similar in terms of kind of the the type of masculinity that they represent. I think when we started Mel, it was sort of quaint, right? I just wanted to talk to guys that I knew about things that I thought were more meaningful to their lives. And that was sort of mental health, their physical health, and not like, you know, six ways to a great six pack, but, you know, why is this happening to my body as I'm aging? You know, just more philosophical Seinfeldian queries. I think once Trump got elected, that's when the phone started ringing to be like, what is going on with men, you know? And then it really crystallized, I think, around Me Too. And we were really the only men's publication to really consistently try to interrogate that. I think it's super important right now for men to sort of get together with this approach of like, we broke it, we bought it. And so if we want to be constructive participants in the social change that's happening, we ought to like sit down and start talking to each other. And in the early days of Mel, I was really trying to rip out of men what I knew we were talking about at bars. One of my favorite compliments is somebody once told me that they've never felt more seen than when they go on Mel. And I was like, well, that was kind of the point. I think post Me Too, it's been very different in the sense that I want to try to foster a group of people, whether in the UK or you know, whatever their background, try to get a number of different men to the table to start having a conversation about, again, not white knighting it or taking over the dialogue, but how can we participate in what's happening in the world?
You know, obviously you think there's a place for gender-defined publications, but is it a big place or is it just you guys?
I'm not sure. You know, I think that in some ways you could say that we almost report more on modern masculinity and what it's like to be a man, not how to be a man. But I'm not even sure I know what kind of male means anymore. I will say that about 40% of our audience is female. I think it's the same way guys used to read Cosmo here in the States to see like what, you know, I think women like that we're very, very honest about masculinity and kind of learn a fair amount from that. I definitely think that there's a new generation coming that doesn't see gender as binary in any real way. For now, masculinity deserves the kind of investigation and interrogation that we're giving it. I think when you recite some of the stories on the site, culturally, I think you can still be a culture publication. It doesn't have to be so gendered.
Part of why I ask a question is the site's like broadly went away, got folded back into the kind of mainstream of Vice. You know, long term, I do wonder, particularly when you look at women's magazines, they're having such a hard time. Like, it's really interesting that 40% of your readership is female.
Yeah, it's like between 35 and 40. I think a lot of the stuff that we say are the stuff they're seeing. And so I think it particularly resonates with them. I think there's an evolution here that's definitely happening in terms of what you're talking about. And I think that part of it is you really do have to look differently. I think Jezebel and The Cut in particular, The Cut, I think, really elevated a lot of what was great about sort of legacy women's lifestyle stuff. I think The Cut kind of, or the Jezebel kind of redefined it with this sort of, you know, sharp elbowed edge. And that's kind of what we're trying to do in the men's space. I think as long as you continue to do that, I think there can be some gender difference. But I think you have to, you know, you have to evolve. And I think that that's the biggest problem with the gender defined publications. If you're going to cover from a gender point of view, I think you have to really kind of, that has to be an ongoing, evolving worldview editorial mission.
So all those stories that we've discussed this week actually came out first in our daily newsletter with commentary from us. Mm. You can sign up to that at voices.media. The pop-up box is now working. Everything on the site is now working, so you will get it. Although do check your junk mail if you sign up for it, because you'll get a subscription confirmation come through first. And if you reply to the daily newsletter with your thoughts, we do see it and we do respond if it's polite.
You can also go to our...
If it's polite, on the floor.
You can also go to our Ko-fi page, where you can kick us a couple of quid to help support the work that we do. So whether that is the daily newsletter, whether that is the weekly podcast, if you like what we do, then please do kick us a couple of quid so that we can invest in better equipment, more developed investigations analysis for the site, and everything else that we want to do to grow.
So go on holiday and stuff.
So please do go to our website, where there's a link to our Ko-fi page. Peter, what is our website?
Our website is voices.media. And on there, you can read a bunch of stuff that we've written. You can go back through our previous 155 episodes. You can do all sorts of stuff. You can sign up for the newsletter, as has just been described. And actually, it's quite a nice website. Also, you can see our social media stuff, which is at Media Voices Pod. Well, before we finish today, I think it's very important that we mention that our very own Esther Keyser-Thorpe has been chosen to be one of PPA's 30 Under 30 Class of 2020.
Woo! Congratulations.
Recognised for all the work she's done on the Media Voices podcast and the Publisher Podcast Awards. Well done, Esther.
Thank you.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with more award-winning analysis and stories, thank you very much for listening and have a great week.
Ta-ta!